Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm doing another Seth's Pick episode, which is a regular episode. Generally, these are one book that's not necessarily a winner of anything other than my desire to reread it or read it for the first time, and one guest. But in this case, I actually have two guests to talk about an old favorite book of mine with a couple of my favorite people, my sister Megan. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
You have been here before, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And then a frequent collaborator with me on other podcasts and on this one is Colin Cuskey. Hey.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yep. And we're just all sitting here in my living room, so family room, I guess. And there's a dog in the room. So that's important because we're talking about a Dean Koontz book, and there's almost always a dog in Dean Koontz books. Other than this one, because we're going to be talking about the 1988 novel Lightning, which was, I think, the first Koontz that I read. Because it was lent me by this dude sitting next to me.
Yeah, it was definitely my first.
It was? Okay. Yeah. What about you, Colin?
So at that time, I think I was buying books from the Safeway just down the way, and it was on the little bookshelf. I also got a Redwall book there, and it was my first Redwall book. Mm. So yeah, also my first Dean Koontz.
Okay, interesting. So when people ask, what's your recommended place to start? This isn't a bad one.
No, in fact, I recommended it to a phlebotomist today.
Wow, okay. Were you reading it while you were in the waiting room or something?
Yeah, desperately, quickly. Like, I got to finish this.
Very nice. Yeah, it was, I mean, years ago, Colin gave me a brown paper bag full of books.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Because I was like, you know, I have not read enough science fiction books. And he's like, well, I'll lend you some science fiction and fantasy, a mix. And I read most of them. And this, I believe, was one of them. And I had never read any Dean Koontz. I'd always been creeped out by the idea of reading Dean Koontz because the book covers looked creepy and I didn't read horror books. So why would I ever read them?
Well, this isn't really a horror book.
No, it isn't. And that's the funny thing. So since then, you know, I've read 27 Dean Koontz books.
Oh, wow.
Because over the years, it used to be that he would put out like 3 books every 2 years.
Yes.
And when I checked one out from the library, I could do a search on him and there would be a placeholder for the next one coming out. And so I was always just right. As soon as the library got him, I got him. And, yeah. And so, yeah, there was a 10-year period where I read everything he published. What about you, Megan?
I've probably read 15 or 20, mostly the really older ones. I actually haven't read much after Odd Thomas.
Okay. Right. And Megan was previously on to talk about Odd Thomas with me.
Yes. Yes.
For a Comfort Reads episode.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That is true.
Very comforting book with a very uplifting ending.
Right. Not sad at all.
No. Speaking of horror.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I think it's funny because maybe I'll post a picture that I took at the library book sale this year. In Washington County, where we live, there's a cooperative of libraries where you can request books from different libraries. Well, every twice a year, the Friends of the Hillsborough Library to raise funds does a Friends of the Library book sale. And so they have them all categorized into a bunch of stuff. There's the murder room that's like just all thrillers and like mysteries and that kind of stuff. And there's horror and there's science fiction and fantasy. Lots of romance because lots of people buy used romance. But this year they had a whole shelf that said Dean Koontz because we don't know where else to put him.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I sent you the picture.
Yeah. And it's true. You don't quite know.
Yeah, where he fits in, because some of his stuff is clearly horror and other stuff is more thriller. Mm-hmm. And then this one is definitely science fiction.
Yeah, it's got some sci-fi. Yeah, definitely has a sci-fi aspect to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this this is a 37-year-old book. So we will go a little spoiler light at the top, but then, you know, I think it's a recommendation from all of us.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. On a reread, how many times have you read this one, Megan?
I couldn't even, at least, I would say 7, maybe 8 times. And then I just did the audiobook last week or the week before.
Okay.
I had never done audio before, but I've read it numerous times.
Yeah, you said, I think before we started recording, that you have it on audio, you have it in ebook, and you have a hardcover.
And I have a hard copy, too. Not hardcover, but yeah, I have it all the way. It's one that will just always be in my collection.
Nice. And what about you, Colin?
Oh, I don't read it yearly like I do The Martian. but I've read it several times just because, yeah, it's a great story. It's, you know, I'm familiar with it. I still enjoy it every time and get excited and scared and worried. And
nice. So I've only read it twice. I read it, you know, 12 years ago and just reread it this week.
Really? Only twice?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, All right.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is, you know, I have a podcast that involves books and another podcast that involves books. And so the extracurricular reading doesn't involve a lot of rereads.
Yeah, that's true.
Somehow Colin manages to still read The Martian every year.
I read Odd Thomas every year, so.
There we go.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you only put out like 12 episodes a year on each. So that should be 24. If you do one a week, that still leaves you, you know, 28 other weeks to read. I mean, come on, yeah. Get with it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know.
You've got to step up your game, buddy.
I know. It's a small group of books that I like to reread.
Yeah.
So what is this book about? Who wants to tackle the inside flap of the book?
I could give a major plot summary, but we'll be sitting here for 5 minutes.
Well, let's try and keep it somewhat spoiler light.
Spoiler light. Okay. Yeah. you ever been someplace and recognized somebody and you weren't sure where they came from, or had incredibly miraculous events happen in your life and then realize that somehow that person you recognize is always the person that shows up when those miraculous events happen? That's this book.
Nice. Yeah.
That's about as concise as I can make it.
Yeah. If we want to get more specific, the main character is named Laura Shane, and she is someone who has had a guardian angel intervening in her life. And she doesn't know who it is, a man of mystery.
Well, and for a long time, she doesn't realize how much he has interfered in her life.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he's interfering on the night of her birth.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And so the book really breaks down into, I think, three sections.
Part one.
And where there's like part one, which is the more standard Dean Koontz kind of thriller / horror thing, because some terrible things happen to Laura.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then it switches into sort of a little love story in the middle, and then into the science fiction part on the back end.
Right. With the sci-fi part
sprinkled. Yeah.
Yeah, because it really does hop back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah, but it maintains the mystery of, like, you don't know how sci-fi it is.
Yeah,
until halfway through the book.
You have suspicions of it being very sci-fi.
Yeah.
And little spoilers throughout, and then you're like, oh, it is very sci-fi.
Yes. Yeah, very much. I think that's about all we can do for non-spoilers.
Right.
So mark this time.
Yes.
Yeah. Get out while the getting's good if you don't want spoilers.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, Colin, when you originally lent it to me, you're like, this is a great science fiction romance. I was like, I don't know if I want one of those. And then I read it. I'm like, yes, I wanted one of those.
Yes, you do. When it's done well, I think it's done really, yeah.
Yeah. And the romance part that kind of leads off the romance part is a different one than you might expect, because there are major characters introduced, but it's not them getting together that's the romance part.
Right.
Yes. Yes. Because we end up following her guardian angel, the thing that I alluded to, and Laura. But then Danny shows up.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's a fun part. So let's talk about the first part. The first part is the more standard Dean Koontz thing where bad things are happening to someone and someone keeps intervening. And like I mentioned, it was a dark and stormy night. It's kind of the beginning of it, right?
Exactly.
Where Laura's mother is in labor and there's a doctor that's about to be called in to help her, and he is very drunk.
Mm-hmm. Right. He's lost his wife and he's very drunk, and then somebody shows up to stop him.
Yep. Call the hospital. Tell him that you're indisposed.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. And we don't understand why until 50% of the way through the book.
Yes.
You know, why would he intervene in her birth?
Right. The interesting thing is, like you said, it is the science fiction part is kind of sprinkled in, and there's another character that's sprinkled in that it kind of keeps going, what is he doing? What is that character doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Kokoschka. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the guardian angel is named, do we call him Stefan?
Yeah,
I think that's how it's always been in my mind and in the audiobook. I think
you don't want him to be Stefan from SNL?
Not Stefan. No. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Little Bill Hader.
Little Bill Hader. Yeah.
Yes. Stefan Krieger. And you don't know much about him for a lot of the book, but the guardian angel, Stefan, you don't know his name for quite a while, steps in and keeps the doctor from intervening. And it turns out that, you know, sure hands were needed because it was a dangerous delivery. The mother dies and Laura is brought into the world and she's perfectly fine. Then, of course, the guardian angel comes and intervenes during a robbery.
Yeah, her dad is a grocery store owner, a little small store. Then she's always there, and somebody comes in to rob them.
Yes.
And definitely and had plans to harm Laura.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stefan comes in and intervenes again.
Yeah, he doesn't give much quarter when he's intervening either.
No, he definitely has some, you know, moral ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. One thing I thought was interesting, one thing that I wrote down was in the first part about the doctor and about the childbirth being dangerous. The doctor kind of delivers the baby and says, sorry, your wife died. She should never have gotten pregnant. And I'm like, that's not real good bedside manner.
Yeah.
I think he's trying to say, you know, there was nothing we could do.
Right.
But it almost sounds like he's blaming Bob Shane for getting her pregnant.
Right. Yeah. And that maybe in 1988, they would have said something like that. But I think these days they'd probably get sued.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. The birth was in 1955.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
even earlier. Like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So it was a, you know, this was doomed from the start.
Mm-hmm.
So be happy that I saved your child.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Sort of thing.
So Laura kind of has a happy life after that. She does witness the killing of the would-be store thief and
participates in the cover-up because the guardian angel also guides them through how to deal with the police. You need to tell this story in this way, otherwise they won't believe you. And if they don't believe you, then Laura could be taken away from you, Bob. And so we need to handle all that.
Yeah, there's that. And she keeps a cooler head than her dad does because he's kind of, you know, he's kind of flipped his lid and he's like frozen, you know, kind of fight or flight. And
well, and she's one of several quite precocious children in this book.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Kuntz kind of does that, I feel like, in a few of his books.
Yeah, there are precocious children in a lot of them, and with really solid vocabularies.
Yes.
Very, very smart.
Yeah.
They're very mature for being 7 or 8.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, eventually Bob passes away, and Laura is only 12 at the time, something like that.
Yeah.
And gets put in a home. And then it goes bad at the home because there is someone that they call the eel.
The eel.
The shorthand that he uses is, well, he carries around candy in his pockets. And that's a creeper play.
Yeah. Yeah. And he definitely targets. And when Laura comes, he targets her.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was amusing that at some point when she confronts him, her big insult to him is calling him a geek.
Right. Right. That's not so much an insult anymore.
No, no, no. I mean, the old-timey definition, right, is like the carnival geek. You know, the kind of person who bites heads off of chickens for entertainment.
Right. And it's definitely taken on a whole new meaning, you know, later. But, you know, back in the 60s or whenever that would have been, for sure that would have been. It's like being a nerd. It's not really an insult anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Even geek is a word that geek culture has appropriated and been like, yes, absolutely, I'm a geek.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But she definitely, you know, misses her father and loved her father. But it also means then that it introduces her, you know, some very integral people into her life as well when she goes into the...
Is it Ackerson? Ackerson?
Ackersons.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Thelma and Ruthie Ackerson, the amazing Ackerson twins,
yes,
as they call themselves.
Yes.
And we see Thelma, you know, for the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I love her. She's awesome.
And they're the other precocious, some of the other precocious children where they, well, my sister is very this, you know, no, well, my sister is very much that, you know.
Right.
And they have all kinds of strategies about you get fobbed off onto foster parents. And they're like, if you don't like it, here are your strategies for getting back.
Right.
You know,
right,
just break some things, you know.
Yeah.
By
yeah.
accident, of course.
Right.
Yes. Cry randomly.
Yeah. And they have strategies for avoiding the eel as well.
Right. Well, they also have a roommate who thinks the eel isn't so bad.
Right.
Who, you know, she's an institutionalized girl.
Right. Right. And yeah, she's a little on the crazy side.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's one of the realities of abuser situations, right? Is that not Stockholm syndrome, in Helsinki syndrome, as in Helsinki, Sweden.
Right. Right. Exactly.
See if everybody gets that joke. We're getting angry letters that are like, it's Finland.
Right.
Yeah. And so that, of course, all gets a little bit tragic, because one of the things that this book introduced to me was the concept of the almost like the Final Destination movies, about destiny trying to reassert itself.
Right.
And you don't really get that. It's more in the back half of the book that you learn about it, but you do start seeing it on a reread, right? Where bad things are supposed to be happening, and so they keep happening, and Laura is adjacent to them. But I didn't remember on the reread, I didn't remember all the bad things that happened at the, I can't remember what the institute was called. Or not the institution, the
McElroy.
McElroy
home. Yeah.
No, McElroy.
McElroy, yeah.
Yeah.
McElroy home.
And yeah, I didn't remember the way all that shook out.
Yeah, there were lots of things that happened there, and, you know, not just to her, but to, you know, Ruthie and Thelma as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she had to go live with the Teagles for a little while and put her plan into effect.
Right, right.
Yep.
Got out of that one real fast.
And then she got put with a much nicer family. Unfortunately, by that time, and this is another thing, right? Like, if you are trying to intervene in someone's life and destiny keeps trying to reassert itself, you could very easily push the wrong button and cause an even worse thing to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens here is he realizes that the eel is going to get to Laura, and that's going to mess her up for the rest of her life. And so he puts the fear of God into him, and that backfires.
And that backfires, yeah. And unfortunately backfires so badly that an actual good family that Laura ends up with, mm-hmm, is damaged because of him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And Willie Sheener is his name, is the eel.
It's a great name for a creeper character.
Yeah, so, Willie Sheener.
Sorry to all the
absolutely.
Willie Sheeners out there.
he's going to be slimy.
Yeah. Yeah. The white eel.
I think is what, yeah. He just is very gross. And I think that Kuntz does a really good job of writing creepers in, you know, several books a lot of his books have a creeper in them.
And, yeah. Like and the Fungus Man in Odd Thomas.
Yeah. The Fungus Man and the wholly unredeemable character and as a, you know, an antagonist. Mm-hmm.
I think, I wonder if he named him the White Eel to prevent racists reading the book from thinking that the character must be black.
Oh,
because there's a point where he mentions about the big Tootsie Roll he's got in his hand. And we all know it's not a Tootsie Roll.
Oh, yes, yes, that's true.
And so I wondered if he deliberately called him the White Eel just to lay that to rest. Like,
to
I'm not implying that this character is black.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, because I think it's just because they only calls him the White Eel like once, maybe mm-hmm. twice, and
after
then
that
he's
just
the eel,
yeah.
Or Sheener, or mm-hmm. you know.
I think when he's beating the tar out of him in his house, he mentions his red hair.
Oh, does he?
He but does.
That's right, he does.
Yeah, he mentions the red hair, and he mentions something about like his really bad skin or something like that, too. Mm-hmm. But he may have still done that to make sure mm-hmm. that there was this is a white guy.
Yeah. I wonder sometimes about writers of books, and this book has a writer character in it. It's like, well, I do research. And some of the stuff I'm like, what kind of twisted research have you done, Dean Kuntz? Because when you go to Sheener's home, you find out there, it's really weird.
Yeah. His home is Creeperville. Mm-hmm.
Well, he's got the room that's like a children's bedroom.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it makes you, you know, I mean, you understand what this guy is about anyway, but it makes you wonder how many people he's kept there, mm-hmm. you know, children he's kept there, or if that was his plan to take Laura there, or,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of, I won't mention a name, but there was one of the kids that I used to play with as a kid whose mom seemed to have a different boyfriend every week.
Right.
One time when one of her boyfriends was there, he had a RV, like a tow camper kind of thing, parked in the driveway. And we went in there one day, and it was absolutely full of candy and pornography.
Oh.
And looking back on that, I'm like, wow, what did that say about this guy?
I don't want to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think things were worse at that house than we knew.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet. Oof, scary.
So do you learn Kokoschka's name pretty early?
Yeah, he's named. And one of the cool things is that at the funeral for Bob Shane, Stefan is there in white. And Kokoschka is there in black. So right. There's an immediate contrast between the two. Mm-hmm. You understand that they're diametrically opposed by the way they're dressed.
Right. Yeah. Well, and Kokoschka is thinking about, I don't know if it's Kokoschka, whatever.
Right.
It refers to Stefan as the traitor.
Right. Right.
And he mentions the Institute. And you're like, what is going on? what? Where are these people from?
Right. And it's just called the Institute the entire time. They never really, I mean, they tell you about that, you know, why it's there, but they just call it the Institute. Yeah, but at, you know, especially at Laura's dad's funeral, he's, you know, why is Stefan coming after you? Why you? Mm-hmm. You know, just trying to solve a mystery.
Right. And biding his time. And he's like, eventually I'm going to kill Stefan and I'm going to get rid of anything that he's doing.
Yeah.
So one thing with Dean Koontz books, and I think we mentioned it, that lots of times there's a dog in the books, right? Because yeah. he loved dogs, right? And in the back flap of a lot of his books, it was he lives in, you know, wherever he lives with his wife Gerda and their dog.
Right.
Now I can't. Trixie, was it?
Trixie at the time of this book.
Yes. Yeah. And then the enduring memory of their dog Trixie, and you know, and over through the years, and I think he even wrote like a children's book about a dog. And so lots of times there's even precocious dogs, for instance, in Watchers.
Yes.
But there's important dogs in lots of his books. But he also seems to love describing architecture.
Yes.
And trees. And one thing I'll say is that some of his prose stylings about, you know, describing trees are really fascinating, are really well done. And I wrote one down. And I think this is after the romance part. So we will talk about that, but I just wanted to read this passage that where he's writing about trees. Leafless black trees thrust bare limbs toward the fulminous sky, as if they were fanatical cultists praising a violent god. Evergreens, boughs drooping under surplices of snow, stood like the solemn priests of a more decorous religion.
Oh, yeah. Like,
there's some $10 words in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and when he starts describing, you know, plants and architecture, like you mentioned, he does the same kind of thing. Yeah. I had to look up, because I don't pay attention to plants very much. Like, what is a ficus and why should I care?
Right.
And I should care because it describes what's going on and why you can't see in from the street. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. At what point, I guess we get her through McElroy and then she goes to essentially it's not juvenile detention, but it's, you know, for people over a certain age until they reach their majority and then they're out on their own. And Laura ends up with a little bit of inheritance from her father.
Uh-huh. You go to school.
And so she goes to school, and this is where she meets Danny. And
yeah, and the whole toad thing is so cute, because mm-hmm. Her father had, you know, started this toad story where he had a little tiny hat and a cane and a scarf, and he put them in their house, and then, you know, say, oh, we have to be careful. We have to be quiet because our toad friend is here. And
yeah, she wrote something, right?
She wrote something for the school paper. Yeah, right. Some sort of publication about the toad story. And she suddenly starts getting toads from a secret admirer.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't know who it is. And it's weird. And it's starting to freak her out. And then it goes on for way too long.
Mm-hmm.
and she tells him that when she meets him.
Yeah, to the point where she's like, okay, I got to trace this guy down.
Right. Right. And that turns out to be Danny, who is a wonderful character.
He is. And you know, he didn't know of her past, right? If, you know, anybody who had been pursued by the eel was going to get skeeved off by this.
Oh, yeah. Eventually. Yeah, for sure.
I don't know if skeeved is a word.
Skeeved is a word. I think it's a word. Okay. Skeevy.
Yeah. And I love the fact of, like, Danny is presented as this handsome, tall, muscular guy.
Really
right?
big.
Yeah. But his approach is so clunky.
he's such a dork.
Yeah.
But it's also really sweet, you know, and when he goes on his diatribe of, you know,
wait, don't hang up. Let me wait,
don't hang up. And I've always had trouble with beautiful women, because my mom was beautiful and she was cold and heartless. It's probably something I should work out in therapy. But I'm really sorry. I can't talk to beautiful women and you're so beautiful. And, you know, just this, you know, page and a half of just ramblings to try and get Laura to, you know, not be mad at him anymore and to understand that he knows he messed up.
Yeah.
But he wants another chance.
Yeah. And then she's like, all right, fine. and gone. And then the first date goes quite poorly.
Oh, so bad.
Yeah. And then he completely messes up the first date. And she's still just like, she's just given him a chance and, you know, and then marries him, what, 8 months later?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, something. But I do like her, well, what kind of financial analyst are you? You know, after that first date goes so poorly. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, I'm really good at that.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful women that freak me out.
Yeah. Yeah. So that part's all very sweet. And it's like a little self-contained part of the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And I should say that even though we're not talking about it very quickly, that Kuntz does a great job with pacing. So we just covered the first 22 to 23 years of Laura's life. Mm-hmm. But in parallel to this, we get all these little vignettes from Kokosha and Stefan. And so it moves and it moves and it moves.
Yeah.
And at one point, I realized I was getting like really tense. And I realized what was going on was he had changed the pacing after Danny and Laura get married to be faster. Mm-hmm. As you're building up to this great big precipitating event that's going to happen.
Yeah, there is. I mean, so I don't think this book is perfect. I think it might be a little clunky in that regard, where it just, boom, exposition dump about all the success that Laura has. It's fine, right. but it is. It does just sort of snowball. Mm-hmm. It's an avalanche of, look at all the successes that she has, and Thelma as well.
And Thelma, yeah. Yeah, and there's part of it, because I was, you know, kind of doing a reread last night going, there are some of parts of this book that probably could have been cut because they don't necessarily move the story forward in a way where they're indispensable, mm-hmm. you know. Still, it's kind of nice to see Thelma actually, you know, throughout the book as well, and and see her successes, mm-hmm. Of these, you know, these two kids that end up coming out of that home, not unscathed.
Right.
But still together.
Yeah. Still as good friends that can only be, you know, the kind of friends that can shared suffering
right.
creates.
Well, and that suffering, you know, that they both experienced the loss of a parent, loss of a sister, I mean, horrible trauma in some ways. It causes in them this trait that people recognize and can identify with, and that they are individually gifted in sharing. So, you know, when Thelma stands up and does her comedy, there's that whole black humor streak right through the middle of
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
right.
And then Laura, able to talk about love and loss and hope and sometimes hopelessness, that she communicates really well in her writing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And she does say, you know, after she loses Danny, that she's writing a book that's black as bile.
Yeah.
You know, and Thelma's like, is there a market for that? And she's like, probably not.
Yeah.
You know, but as a writer, I have to get it on the page. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then she's like, at the same time, when I get tired of that, I'm writing this really cute,
the Mr. Toad stuff,
a Mr. Toad book for kids, you know. And she does end up with a child, but same thing with her mom's pregnancy. She is unable to have more kids. She and Danny have Chris. But she's unable to have more children, which shows the progression of time where, you know, medical science has made it so that, you know, she survived, but she's still unable to have more kids. And that's kind of tragic to her because as an orphan, she never wanted Chris to be alone.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and she talked about how she wanted to have a large family so that, you know, she's assuming that bad things are going to continue to happen to her whole life. If she loses one, she'll still have family there.
Yeah.
Which is.
So some of the stuff about Laura's success just it makes me think that it's like author wish fulfillment kind of stuff, especially when you look at the numbers that for the financial deals that she's getting on these books in the 80s in the timeline of the book.
That's true. I mean, what was it? It was 2.2 or 2.4 million for her second book.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I understand, like when stuff gets optioned for movies, that's lots of times where the big money comes in. We learned that talking to Edward Ashton about Mickey 7,
right?
Where you know, daughter got to go to dental school.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if there's a clunky part of the book, it's sort of that for me. But it does establish that her writing is important, mm-hmm. right? And it turns out that it was very important because this is why her guardian angel was attracted to her.
Right.
And wanted to better her life.
Right. Right. And then you start to see why why he has been her guardian angel all of this time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we have held back on the major spoiler thus far, right?
So that is true. That is true. We haven't
because the book does, right? And we've kind of been talking through it in order. And so yeah, after that point, there is the encounter that happened where all the plot lines kind of come together with the guardian angel and the mystery guy pursuing him, because Stefan is coming through, and you have some notion that there's time travel involved.
Yeah.
But no, you don't know specifically where he's coming, when he's coming from. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and it's the, it's also the title of the book is Lightning.
Right.
You start to figure out that lightning happens when the time travel is happening.
Yeah.
And that becomes a theme throughout the book. And of course the title.
Yeah. Yeah. Which evidently he didn't like, but maybe we can get back to that.
He always says that wasn't the title of that I had in mind for the book.
Oh, that's a pretty common story.
That's not a shocker. Yeah.
Yeah. So Stefan is realizing I have to stop them from being on this particular road at this particular time because they're going to be killed in a terrible accident.
Right.
So he shows up, is able to prevent that happening, but then Kokoschka shows up and things go quite poorly.
Quite poorly. Yes.
And that isn't when Stefan is wounded. But Danny is killed.
But Danny is killed. Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, again, that destiny reasserting itself, you know, destiny doesn't want her to be happy,
right.
You know, and so takes that huge happiness away from her and Chris. Mm-hmm. And then Stefan is like, I will be here in another few days. And yet it ends up being another year before he shows up because his calculations are wrong.
Right.
And so you start seeing what it takes to do the time travel as well. But you still don't know, is he coming from the future? Is he coming from the past?
Right.
You know,
right.
We assume the future.
Yes. Yeah. The reader is meant to assume the future.
Well, it's how Kuntz deals with the whole, the paradox problem.
Yes.
You avoid the paradox problem by saying there can never be a paradox, which means you can never travel to your past.
Right. Yeah. Your personal past is off limits for you. And this is where the precocious Chris comes in.
Yes. Right?
I wouldn't have minded him being slightly older because he's only like 8.
Yeah.
And he's very much like, mom, time travel paradox. And I know all about this, you know?
Right, right, right. But again, it's the overly smart child. And that's kind of a Kuntz thing. You know,
it does remind you of like the 8-year-olds that know the name of every single dinosaur that has ever existed and where they were located. And because they're just sponges then soaking up knowledge.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Whatever it is that they get fixated on, it just seems to be dinosaurs for most kids.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. I was definitely that way. Yep. So I don't know when is it that we find out for sure where he's from?
It's not until he is. He's wounded. Like the year later, he shows up, and it's they're in a hotel, and she is assuming he's from the future,
right?
And but he's wounded in the hotel bed, and Kokoschka and his Nazis have shown up and torn her house apart, and they have gone on the run, which is. This is very telling that it is an older book because there's no GPS, there's no books there or phone tracking and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And that's, there are definitely parts of the book where you go, it's telling that this is such an old book because they don't have all of that kind of thing. And it's easier to disappear in that timeline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you introduced cell phones or something, you know, that would mess up a lot of the story here because like you said, Stefan shows up again, but he's been wounded, grievously wounded, and says, you got to go now. You know, he shows up at her place. I think he tells her to be prepared before he leaves and he's going to come back in a couple days.
Right. He asks her to keep the belt. He says, never press it because you do not want to go where it's going to take you.
Right.
And then he goes back to the Institute to finish his plan, which is to destroy the Institute completely so that the people using it cannot do the evil things that they were planning to do. And it's never, like we were talking about, it's never fully described what's going on until later in the book.
Yeah.
But you know kind of early on that Stefan knows the people that he's working for now are not good people and he wants to stop them.
I feel like Kuntz having a bad guy named Kokoschka leads you towards, oh, it's Russians. It's bad Russians, you know? Mm. And like the names sound more like that. And you find out that, like, I think it's a Polish scientist who came up with everything.
Right.
But yeah, that's kind of a little misdirection. If he had given everybody German names, it might have given away the plot.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she prepares herself, goes full Linda Hamilton in T2, you know? I don't know if she's doing the, you know, the pull-ups and stuff, but but she is training with weapons and training
martial arts.
Yeah, with martial arts and training Chris to, you know, to be able to reload things and to kind of have some emergency plans, escape plans. And so when Stefan comes through and he's wounded and he says, they're coming, we've got to go. And then he's basically useless the rest of the time.
Right.
She is able to go and say, Chris, we've got to go. You know, and he gets up, doesn't complain. He kind of saves the day by starting the car and getting the garage door opening. And so she can get away. And then that's when you get into I thought it was a really, really well done sequence where they're driving away. They're trying to escape. They're in a Jeep and the bad guys hotwire her car or take her keys or whatever. And that car is more powerful than the Jeep or the 4x4, whatever it is. But they're out in, not in the weeds, but, you know, not out in the sticks, but
mountains
adjacent to the sticks. Yeah. The mountains. And so she's able to drive far enough to get to someplace where her vehicle is an advantage.
Right. Right. In and there's a big storm.
Yeah.
And it's a snowstorm, mm-hmm. which, you know, a 4x4 is going to be better for that than, but it's a Mercedes, I think, is what her other car is. So mm-hmm.
yeah. But like many Kuntz characters, she starts to get a sense that there's something bad about to happen. She's being pursued by people, but she's like, if I keep on this road, something bad is going to happen. And she has that intuition. And she basically says to Chris, look, if this is something to do with time travel and you were the bad guys, what would you do? Mm-hmm. Like, well, I would know that you took this road and I would turn back and go back to wherever I came from and ambush you on the other side where this comes out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so she changes her plans and, you know, kind of depends on him a little bit to be the one who, you know, can kind of see where should they go, you know, until Stefan is able to say, hey, look, if you hear the lightning, it means that they know where you are.
Yeah.
And they are Nazis. And so they're from the past. And, you know, Stefan reveals it, they've thought that he's from the future and it turns out that he is from the past. And, the Nazis have created this device, that, the Lightning Road, and that device takes them into the future so they can get, you know, ideas or technology. They find out that Hitler has lost the war and they're trying to correct that, mm-hmm. And then Kokoschka is thinking that Stefan is trying to, you know, stop Hitler from succeeding. Mm-hmm. But then there's this, you know, how is Laura part of that? Not realizing that Laura really is kind of just, you know, Stefan's
side quest.
Yeah. not part of the main quest.
Yeah.
In fact, when they're talking about Chris, you know, and she's asking him all these questions. She names, well, you know, you like Star Wars and Star Trek and uh-huh. Indiana Jones. And it reminded me of conversations we've had in the past, Seth, about how very few science fiction books mention popular culture because, one, it dates it, which is okay in this case.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, it establishes Chris's bona fides, mm-hmm. right?
It's funny, though, because like some of the references, I mean, you really do understand how dated it is because Thelma's absolutely in love with Paul McCartney because right. he's gorgeous.
Yes.
You know, and I'm thinking, you know, somebody these days may not even know who Paul McCartney is, you know.
Yep. And she's going to be in a movie with Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy, yes. Yeah. And she's she occasionally hosts The Tonight Show with, you know, she steps in for Johnny Carson, mm-hmm.
You know. And, not Jimmy Fallon.
Not Jimmy Fallon.
Not Jay Leno.
Yeah, and not Jay Leno. So, it is very old in those references there.
Yeah.
But it's that's all okay. Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah, it's a time capsule book, right? And that's totally fine. But yeah, so the plan of the evil Nazis, I hate those guys, as yes. Indiana Jones said. I guess I hate these guys, whatever, is to, basically go forward into the future, look at history books, bring back documentation, find what kind of weapons or technology that they could use to bring back to help the Nazis win the war. And, you know, it's 1944. So it is deep into the war and not everything is going super well.
Right.
I guess 1944 is when that's when D-Day was, and then the Battle of the Bulge and all that kind of stuff. And so,
yeah. Except we're pre-D-Day because later on.
Well, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So I guess the war is still going pretty well at that point.
Well, there's a turn, mm-hmm. right? Hitler's and the Nazis are starting to lose, and so they need the benefits from the Blitzstrasse of the Lightning Road in mm-hmm. order to, you know, to turn the war back around into their favor.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, they want to bring back nuclear technology because their technology hasn't been destroyed yet due to the heavy water wars.
Right.
And
they want an advantage in completing their nuclear ambitions, right? Atomic ambitions. What was the other thing?
Uzis.
It's not an 80s book or movie without Uzis.
Right? You gotta have Uzis. Yeah.
Like, I look at that and I'm like, that's, like for a Terminator, I understand, right? Yeah, a Terminator that has machine aiming and machine strength, sure. But nobody's shooting an Uzi with any accuracy.
Yeah.
Unless you're Laura Shane, who can saw somebody's head right off.
Yeah, pretty much.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Apparently. But it also, you know, because she talks about, like Thelma says, how did you get all of this stuff? And she's like, I'm a writer. I research everything. And I'm like, you know, I mean, it's kind of telling, like Dean Koontz, has he done that kind of research?
Right.
Would he be able to get, you know, fake IDs and, you know, all of that and illegal weapons and,
He's got that big impressive toupee now. There's probably a gun under it.
So. That's entirely possible. Or he hides one in his dog.
Could be.
But I do like to, in the year that Stefan is gone, she does the Tommy Toad thing with Chris. And so they, and it's kind of the last thing that you hear about Tommy Toad in the book. Mm-hmm. But it's still kind of a cute little web mm-hmm. throughout the book. And then Stefan also reveals to her, you know, anytime you hear the lightning, it means that they have found you because they've gone back, they've looked her up, mm-hmm. Or they've gone forward and they've looked her, that's what they've done, if they've gone forward to see where she shows up,
right.
And looking at police reports and, you know, all of that. And then they come back and, and they can find.
Yeah. And it's very convenient. The whole idea of they talk about the paradoxes. You can't create paradoxes. However, anything that's from the future from 1944 is pretty much fair game, unless they've taken a trip where taking another trip would put them able to interact with themselves.
Right.
So you can definitely change the future from 1944, but you can't change your personal past kind of in any of those senses, unless you can.
Right.
Turns out there is a way to get around it.
Yeah.
It's not a guarantee.
It's more like thing. Guidelines.
Guidelines. Exactly.
So I feel like I kind of lost the thread. So Stefan shows up to save Danny and Laura and Chris from a car accident, mm-hmm. says, I'll be back in a few days. They have a gunfight with Kokosha and they kill him.
Yes.
Then Stefan goes back to the Institute and finds Kokoshka, and
right.
he's totally confused for a little while until he begins to work it out that he killed Kokoshka from the future and how he's dealing with him in the past. And from that point forward, he cannot kill him.
Right.
Because that would cause a paradox in Stefan's past. Mm-hmm. And just the writing and the detail and the logic that he put into it. And the fact that he stays so tight to his own rules, I really liked.
Yeah.
I like
that
a lot.
It does give you a little bit of a headache sometimes.
Like, a little bit. Yeah. Like,
I feel for Laura when Chris is describing the paradox and why it can't be like this. And he and Stefan are, you know, talking to each other about this. And she's like, I'm getting a headache.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, talking about the, like, if people can find you in the future, then they're not going to wait until, you know, like the moment that you pop up in that place. They're going to trace you back as far as they can from that place. Like if you were using an assumed name or something, and mm-hmm. then that name sometime in the future got kind of repaired back up with another identity, now they can trace you all the way back through that identity. And a given infinite time, which of course nobody has. And so they're taking their jaunts, I believe they call them. And looking up what they can look up and then trying to accomplish their mission. If it's not working out, boom, we're going to head back to the barn and try again, right? Because they can do that.
Well, and that at the same time, Stefan reveals that anytime they travel back, they're only, what was it, 18 minutes?
11 minutes.
11 minutes. Yeah. 11 minutes from the time that they left. And yeah. So it doesn't matter if he stayed 3 years or 3 minutes.
Yeah.
It will be only 11 minute difference from mm-hmm. when he left the first time. And that's why he never ages.
Right.
When, you know, every time Laura sees him over her 20 something years of life, mm-hmm. or, you know, at that point, 30 years of life.
Yeah. It was only a few weeks for him.
Yeah. It's only a few weeks for him. Yeah. And every time he goes back, it's 11 minutes from when he left.
Yeah. Well, and that leaves him somewhat vulnerable, right? Because he knows people can just wait 11 minutes and you're going, no matter how long you're gone, if you come back, you're coming back 11 minutes later and we can be waiting for you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And because of the gunfight, he expects to be met by Kokoschka when he goes back to the Institute.
Right.
After the fight on, I think it was Little Bear. Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting because at the beginning of the book, you know, Laura is just a baby or just a little girl. And it's talking about how Stefan is setting the Institute up to blow up because right. he wants to destroy everything. He knows he has to destroy the scientists and all of the research and the machinery. And so you've got that, but then he's still doing that when she's 25 years old mm-hmm. as well, because he's done these leaps forward, leaps back, you know, but it's only 11 minutes or it's only a few weeks.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And so I, that part I find really fascinating and just plain good writing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, Kuntz didn't write a whole lot of science fiction, but like he's got a sure hand with the science fiction parts.
Yeah.
Well, he does a lot of paranormal,
yeah.
supernatural science fiction, maybe more fantasy based. Mm-hmm. Cause when you think about some of the other books, like, you know, Midnight, very science fiction based.
I haven't read that one.
Oh. Midnight came immediately after this book. Very okay. science fiction based.
Okay.
Definitely horror.
Okay.
Definitely horror.
Definitely yeah. horror.
But Watchers even has a sci-fi aspect to
right.
it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And Watchers is another one that's one of my favorites. It's kind of like Odd Thomas and Lightning are like at the top. And then there's just below that is Watchers. Well, Watchers is so fantastic.
Super dogs.
Yeah. And if you super love dogs. Yeah, that's the thing. I wish the adaptation had been better. Mm.
Well, I wish the adaptation of Odd Thomas had been better, but
yeah. Now, Watchers also doesn't Watchers have the creepy serial killer guy who thinks he's absorbing life force? Kuntz is really good at writing that kind of character.
Yeah, yeah. That wholly unredeemable. Mm-hmm. He is pure antagonist.
Yeah.
Real crazy.
Yeah, pretty sure he's immortal. Right, because of all the life force that he's absorbing. He thinks he's immortal because
he's taking lives. Yeah,
but we're not talking about that.
But we're not talking about that one. But that one, that one is another one that's a favorite and kind of a not necessarily sci-fi, but like a you know, scientists have experimented and made, you know, this very smart dog and then this total abomination.
Right, right. Trying to make you know, efficient soldiers.
Right, right. Exactly. So, and I can see why. He's very hard to classify. You know, where will you find Kuntz? In several different places in the library.
So, yeah, then we're fully into the science fiction part of it, because now it's how do you run from people who can go to the future and find out where you're going to pop up, right? And so they hole up in a motel for a while to try to, you know, they have to look for a seedy enough one that they can pay cash and nobody's going to ask them for ID.
Yes, but not so seedy
that it's, you know, someone taking advantage of undocumented people, and all the rooms are full with entire families.
Right, right.
Who are also being taken advantage of by farmers,
yeah,
and paying them pennies because they know they have no recourse.
Well, and this is where her lifelong relationship with Thelma comes in, because you need someone that you completely trust that won't leak or, you know, whisper about you behind your back, mm-hmm. because they need money and supplies, and they're afraid to leave the hotel room to do that in case somebody sees Laura, because, you know, she has become so popular that she has one huge benefit and one huge disadvantage. The benefit is she has tons of money. The disadvantage is she's well known and recognizable and has had her picture on the back flap of all of her books, right, like Dean Koontz.
Right.
And so, cannot, go to the laundromat or go to a doctor's house in the middle of the night with someone who's been shot and not be recognized.
Right. That was funny that he recognized, he thinks the whole thing's a joke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the calmest guy to ever be held at gunpoint.
The doctor that, is stitching up Stefan, and but she does have to, when she hears the lightning, the doctor's like, how do you know that I'll say anything? And she's like,
Because they're here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's scrupulously honest, right?
Yes.
And so, of course he's going to inform the police, but also, that gives her the information that, okay, I'm more recognizable than I thought I was. So I really got to be careful.
Yeah, and that's where, Thelma, who is also incredibly recognizable, right, kind of comes into the picture and, can give her money and gives her a place to stay at one point with Stefan and Chris. And that's kind of a calm before the storm time.
And she shows up in like with fake teeth and a wig.
Because she thinks that's hilarious.
Yeah, and when...
And she was going to drive her own car. And she realized, I can't show up looking like this going to that place in a $60,000 Beamer because it'll just won't fit. So I had to borrow.
The gardener's car.
Right. Truck. First, she tried to take the chauffeur's car, but he drove like a Porsche or something.
Right.
Yeah. So she shows up in a beat up old pickup truck and in a get up. And Koontz has this patter between characters.
Oh, yeah.
In a lot of his books.
Yeah, banter.
Yeah, where people are very, very eloquent. And I mean, it's sort of a Sorkin kind of thing. Koontz has his own version of that.
Totally. There's a snarkiness, familiarity, joking. I mean, we do it among ourselves, right? But you don't often read it, and it's so enjoyable.
Yeah. I could picture people being off-put by it and saying, this is a little too twee, but I really enjoy it.
I enjoy the banter. And some of it is kind of corny and, whatever, but... It's also fun.
It's just fun.
And you need moments of levity in books like this. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I like his books so much, is because he doesn't take himself too seriously, even though he's taking himself really seriously.
Yeah. When she shows up with the money, they asked for a certain amount of money, like a couple thousand dollars, and she brought them $10,000 or $12,000.
Yeah.
Right.
And she says, when my friends are on the lam, I insist they go first class.
Right.
And that's the most tame of the lines that I think are in the book when they're talking between each other like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And Thelma doesn't even realize everything that's going on because Laura hasn't really told her everything, but she just is like, you need help. Yeah. I will be there.
Right or die.
It doesn't matter. Yep. And, maybe she's thinking, oh, Laura's lost her cheese. She's lost it, but I'm still going to support her. And I love that, the ride or die friendship like that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to question it. I'm just going to bring you a whole bunch of money. Mm-hmm. And she will always be there for her. Mm-hmm. And I love that.
So Laura runs all the way across town when the fire happens and they lose Ruthie. And all this time in the future when, she's struggling with what to do when Danny's, she calls her friend Thelma and they kind of work it out over the phone. And
Thelma is definitely the auntie to Chris and, loves him, adores him. And they are always out for each other's good.
Yeah.
Which is precious.
Mm-hmm. There was one thing about Chris that threw me, and it's because I'm so stuck on details. Mm-hmm. What is Chris's full name?
No idea.
Christopher.
Okay. He is referred to as Christopher Robin.
Yes.
Yes.
But the day he is born, he is called Christopher Robert. So I don't know if they're nicknaming him Christopher Robin to make an allusion to Pooh and story tales and everything.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure, but yeah, and that part actually made sense to me. Christopher Robin, I would call him Christopher Robin as well, even though he's Christopher Robert.
Yeah.
Okay. I do remember that was his real name.
Growing up, I was called Cethus Morganus.
That is true.
Cethus Morganus?
Cethus Morganus. Yes,
that was my Morgan. Roman name.
Morganus.
Yes.
Okay.
Morganus. Yep. Yes. Yep. That's true. I haven't remembered that, so now you're going to be Cethus Morganus for a while again.
All right.
Your secret is safe with me. I won't tell.
It is not safe with me.
No.
You're a sister.
But I'm your big sister, so. Yeah.
So I like, essentially they move into the end game, right, where Stefan is like, I got to go back to the future.
Right.
I guess it's the past.
Yes.
Past. And I have to, you know, and they get a nerve agent that they can use to
Vexon,
wipe out everybody in there, because they have to kill the intellectual, you know, the these ideas are in someone's mind, right? And so if they've come up with it once, they can do it again. And so he needs to destroy all the equipment, wipe out all the people. It's not pretty. It's, you know, circumstances that he didn't want to be in. But yeah, he actually has to go back and execute that plan.
But again, with the, you know, moral ambiguity, he's okay to do that if it means that Laura is safe.
And the downfall of the Nazi regime, right?
Because
that's the thing. At some point, he's musing that, you know, the Nazis that he's going to be killing. It's like they committed atrocities in the name of the people and called that courage. They were willing to die for a twisted totalitarian ideal, and they called that courage when it was really stupidity, insanity. Of course, none of that's relevant to today.
No, more people should read Dean Koontz's book. Although I will say, it felt like there were several places where he was making cultural and societal statements about our love and fear of guns, and then he contrasted that with Swiss culture, where everyone knows how to handle guns, and they don't have the problems that we knew in the United States. Mm-hmm. And then there was also some statements about the government and some other things.
Oh yeah, I mean he will definitely ride a hobby horse. There's several of his books where he's super libertarian.
Okay,
I can't remember the name of one of the books, but it's just a big screed against eminent domain, which. You know, when you break it down, yeah, okay, I can get behind some of his thoughts there. But he kind of spins out some of his philosophy with Laura, because Chris says, you know, did you kill those men? And she says, yes. And he says, good. And she's like, no. It's not good. You know, there are kind of two polar opposite evils here. One of them is might makes right. And the other one is complete pacifism.
Right.
And we need to live somewhere in between those.
And he doesn't use the line, but they were all bad.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, but they're all bad.
Yeah, especially the dude whose head basically got cut off.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like the intricacies of when talking about how good the science fiction is, where one of the things that I thought was really cool was that the way the belts work is they're an anchor to the time where you left. Because essentially it's a big drum, right? A big barrel that they walk through, that made of copper, and it's kind of suspended. It reminded me of A Sound of Thunder. With the walkway that hovers above everything.
So
you don't accidentally tread on a butterfly or something.
Never happened.
But they go through that, and once they pass a certain point, that pushes them through time. And if it's the kind of thing where it would create a paradox, they bounce right back. If it's not, they go through and then they return, like we said, 11 minutes later.
Right.
But it's that belt that tethers them. And so when Kokoschka comes through and is killed, Stefan has Laura hold on to that belt. And
exactly.
Then he uses it later, and that allows him to go back to 11 minutes after Kokoschka left, which was after he had left before. So it allows him to kind of leap over time. So it's fun intricacies of time travel that he gets into the weeds of some of that stuff, which I really like.
Yeah. I wish they had done a little bit of they, because you know that they come back in 11 minutes. At some point, they know that Stefan is never coming back. 11 minutes after he leaves and gets shot by Kokoschka, he does not come back, which means he's either dead, or he is not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So then there should have been some more thinking about the temporal paradoxes and stuff. And at one point, Stefan talks about that Kokoschka thought he could go back and save this by doing some things, and then because he didn't really understand how the technology worked and
Well, and then Stefan is, telling him about all of this, and Laura is wondering why, how she's involved in this. And this is when he reveals that she doesn't really have anything to do with the whole Nazi thing.
Right.
There's no reason for that. She is not integral to that particular plot. It's just when he had been working for the Institute, he had made several jumps into the future, and at one point read one of her books and loved it so much, and then figured out that and he had actually been at a book signing and figured out that she was in a wheelchair. And then Chris and Laura are like, I was crippled. Mm-hmm. Mom was crippled, you know. And then he starts saying, yes, and I read this book by this title. And she's like, I've never written a book with that title. Mm-hmm. And that's where he reveals that he went back and stopped her from being born crippled.
Right. Her whole life is an alternate history.
Yeah. And then she's like, what am I supposed to do with that? You know, mm-hmm. and then eventually reveals that it was because he had fallen in love with her.
Right. And I came across time for you, Sarah.
Right, right. It's total Terminator. Although, well, this book was written about the same time as Terminator came out. So, or a couple of years after Terminator came out, because that's like 85, I think.
Stefan wasn't wearing piss-soaked bum pants, though.
That is true. That is true.
Probably.
He stole my pants. Yeah, anyway, so it's, you know, that's when, you know, the true why I came back is because I'm in love with you. And,
yeah.
And that's, but Kokoschka.
And I'm working against the Nazis.
But Kokoschka, yeah. You know, then eventually figures that out, mm-hmm. you know, oh, she really doesn't have anything to do. She is completely expendable because yeah. he had kept her alive, even though he was at certain points,
yeah.
he would have been able to kill her.
Yeah. But it also in that, and she's reluctant to even ask him about it. Right. Cause she's staying on what's important right now, but eventually she's like, why me?
Right.
But at that point, and when he starts talking about the destiny reasserting itself, she realizes in the original timeline, I didn't have a family.
Right.
And so what kind of danger is Chris in?
Right.
And that really amps up the possible danger for her.
Yeah. Is Chris going to be taken away from me
yeah.
because he wasn't supposed to exist in the first place? Mm-hmm. Only reason he was is because you interfered.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that, you know, that's where I start going.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because you know, I mean, I know the ending of the story. I know it, but I'm, you know, so ADHD that I get involved, and mm-hmm. you know, even though I've read this book probably 10 times, it stresses me out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he basically intervened. I mean, you could see it as kind of ableist of him to say, well, let me intervene in her life and make it so she's not a poor handicapped person. Right.
Right
and
right, right.
There's lots of people who are, you know, have embraced their, there's diversity days for disability.
Right. Right.
As well. That's one of the things, the parts of DEI that jerks who object to it don't understand that there's more to diversity and inclusion than just what race or ethnicity you are. There's right. also different levels of ability and you know, physical handicaps and that kind of stuff that's
right.
included in that. Like putting ramps in places, that's DEI stuff.
Yeah. yeah.
So.
Or audible crosswalks or mm-hmm. braille signage in hospitals.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He just kind of spins out how her original life was going to be very different.
Yeah. And then, you know, she tells him, I'm not in love with you. You know, I mean, it's only been a year since Danny passed away anyway, or, you know, was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, now she is on the run and the news has come out and said, you know, she was involved with some drug dealer or something or another. And, you know, that's the reason why she's on the run. They're trying to find, you know, the police are trying to find her mm-hmm. as well as Kokoschka and his goons and, you know, his literal Nazis.
Yeah.
and, so they're, you know, very much in a cross country, you know, or not necessarily cross country, but cross state and mm-hmm. all over California.
Right. Right.
Most of his books are really in California.
A lot of them. Yeah. Yeah. That was actually a fun thing when we did our big road trip back in the 2013. I think it was 2013. Where we went down through like Barstow and places and we're like, oh, Pico Mundo is right around here someplace.
Right, right.
From Odd Thomas.
the little imaginary place.
Yeah. But the Stefan's plan, at some point he realizes Kokoschka definitely has disabled my explosives because he sets up a whole bunch of explosives, yeah. wants to destroy it. And he's like, the only way I'm going to get this destroyed is if I can get the Allies involved. And so he has to make a couple special jaunts. And one of them is to Churchill.
Yeah.
And then another one is I need to try to help Destiny reassert itself about the Nazis losing the war by going and talking to Adolf Hitler.
Right.
And this is part of his redemption arc, right? Colin loves a good redemption story.
I love a redemption story.
Where like Stefan Krieger is from a good Nazi family, Right.
Who was with Hitler in the beginning.
Yeah.
And that's how he got this exalted position. Mm-hmm. He was a brown shirt, then he went right into the SS. And
yeah. And by the way, when I say a good Nazi family, I understand it's a contradiction in terms.
Right.
But he was in the Hitler Youth.
Right.
Stefan was. And so he feels that he has a lot to atone for because of the evils that came out of all of that. And so he's doing his bit, and he has to go and talk to Hitler and plead kind of help with Hitler's vanity.
Right.
To get him to understand that, no, you really are smarter than everyone.
You are smarter than everybody else. Yes. And you should, but you've got to stay this course or go back to this course.
Yeah.
And
your plans were correct.
Yeah.
And,
believe those other people.
He even uses anti-Semitism. Hitler's only anti-Semitism against him by saying, well, it's Jews in the Institute that are working against you.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So I thought that was really smart.
That would never work today.
No, never. World leaders that can be appealed to their vanity, they don't exist.
Right. No, not at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so that's fun. And then, I don't know, we don't have to talk about the very end of the book. We can let people actually experience it themselves. But there's a fun little extra alternate history twist right at the end, which is fun.
Well, yeah. So I think that Koontz went back to his horror roots there for a little bit.
How so?
Oh, you're thinking of one alternate history. I'm thinking of a different alternate history.
Okay.
I won't say no more.
We're going to have to talk about it then, because I'm not sure which one is, who's talking about what.
All right, fine. We're spoiling everything.
Okay. Spoil it all.
So during the interview with Churchill, being an extremely intelligent man, asks him a question about the future.
Yes.
And Stefan answers it. And so there's a change in the future, which I want to come back to. Mm-hmm. But the other alternate history I'm thinking is that in the plot, history once again tries to reassert itself, and Stefan must again step into his guardian role.
Oh, yes.
And I think that's where Koontz goes back to his horror roots. So he starts developing this horror thing all the way through, right? Loss of family, fear of family. Chris gets these weird Chinese cookie fortunes that cancel each other out.
Right.
And then what's going to happen next?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yes, and that we can leave a bit of a mystery.
So yeah, I think it's a very, very fun book, very entertaining read. It pretty quick. You give yourself a week.
It's 400 pages, and it's definitely a thriller page turner kind of book. You will not want to put it down.
Oh yeah. Well, there's several Koontz books that I read in a day, right? Because they were just, I was sick or whatever, or they just, like, Life Expectancy, I think, was one of my favorites that just, I couldn't put that one down. Mm-hmm. That one was a lot of fun. A long time ago in the Patreon feed, I posted an episode about all the Koontz books that I'd read and the ones I recommended. So if you're a patron, search the archives if you're interested in being Koontz.
It's so funny because you've read a lot, so many more of the newer ones than I have. Mm-hmm. And I've read all the old ones.
Yeah. I've only picked up a few of the older ones that were just like ones that were in the Cornelius Public Library on tape back in the day.
Right.
And so, like, Strange Highways.
Well, and I remember our cousin Earl told me once, don't read Mr. Murder. That was like the one he said, don't read that one. And I know there's like a movie about that one. I never have read it. I really have not. But I read one, Icebound, and there's one about Midnight something or another.
Yeah.
And there's
Cold Fire.
Yeah. And I read so many of the older ones, but I avoided Mr. Murder because
was Mr. Murder the one where you're in the murderer's head?
So yeah. So, I've told you this in the past. When I read, I put myself in the story and try and feel and sense and see what's going on.
Why you're not a big fan of the downer ending like I am.
That's so Mr. Murder is one of the few books I have started and never finished.
Okay.
Because at one point I understood and that was not an understanding that I wanted to have.
Okay. Nice. So, yeah, big recommendations, Lightning.
Yeah, huge.
From all of us.
Yeah.
It's been on the list for a while, so.
Yeah, this is definitely one that I recommend to anybody who, and it's not, this one, I mean, it has the horror aspect to it, but it's just such a good book.
Yeah. All right. I think we're wrapped, yeah?
Yeah.
All right. Perfect.
All right. Timed this perfectly so Megan would be in town, so thank you for being here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
I love it.
And Colin, thanks for you've always told me if I ever do a podcast on Lightning, then you're willing.
Oh yes.
It was funny because I mentioned I think we were talking about doing it at some point. And then I mentioned it in passing to Megan and she's like, oh, I love that book. I'm like, oh, well, you should do it too then.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that is I mean, just seriously a favorite.
That is one thing we didn't talk about very much, and that's why it's a favorite. What is it about this particular story versus some other story?
Honestly, it is that it's so just, it never lets up. And I like a book with nonstop action.
Yeah.
It really doesn't let up. Mm-hmm. And when it does let up and they're just in the hotel or at Thelma's house, then you're getting backstory.
You're learning stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and so, I mean, he really just does that so well. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I think I just really love the characters. The characters are so... And you, it breaks your heart because you love Dani so much, but you also know she needs to be with Stefan.
Yeah.
I don't know. He writes characters well.
It had been long enough since I read this that the only thing I remembered was Laura in a wheelchair.
Oh.
And so I thought, oh, that's right. When Danny's killed, she must be shot too. And she's in a wheelchair for the rest of the book. And that was what I was picturing was going to happen. But I was wrong.
Yep.
That was a reality that was cut off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did wonder how Stefan was able to change the future, because he had traveled to the future and the thing he had leaked to Churchill was not there. And then later on he leaks and then he comes back and it's different. Mm-hmm. And it said that he, because he had been in the timeline in multiple places, that he knew the difference,
yeah,
that no one else did. Mm-hmm. Right. But if it was in his past, how was he then able to change it?
Yeah. I don't think the book invites that kind of speculation. I think the last chapter is almost a throwaway. But was there anything interesting in the afterword in the book?
Just the fact that, you know, Kuntz wrote this, and it was not a standard Kuntz kind of book. It was very different. And his agent said, look, it's a good book, I'll admit that, but you need to sit on this for a number of years, 7 years maybe, before you take it out. Mm. And he never gave up on it, and he pushed it through. And in a way, it really mirrors Laura's story in Publication.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, and how, you know, this wasn't the title he wanted for the book. Midnight wasn't the title he wanted for the sequel. And yet it's, you know, one of his most popular books ever. Mm. So, you know, Mr. Kuntz, if you ever hear this, the odds are small. Thank you for sticking to your guns, because you made something totally incredible that many, many people enjoy.
Are you suggesting absolutely Midnight is a sequel to this book?
Wait a minute. It's the one that comes after.
Okay.
It is not
because I was like, I don't remember it being a sequel.
No. It's the next book that he writes.
Right. Okay. Right. Okay. Good, because I thought that I had completely missed... My head exploded there for a second.
Yeah, and for a second there, you were thinking that maybe like Odd Thomas got some sequels, and that's not true.
No.
You read the first book, and that's all. There aren't any others.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did I ever tell you about my rule, no Kuntz after 10?
Yeah. Well, you have nightmares. I don't have nightmares.
Yeah. It was always like, okay, you gotta, unless it was like an Odd Thomas book or one of his series, then it was a known quantity and I was going to be okay. But so many of his books, you know, build up to this climax. And like, if you go to bed right before you get to the part where the home invasion is going to occur or something, you're going to dream about home invasions all night. If you're me,
then you're going to talk about it in your sleep.
Well, no, I mean, it literally happened to me where I think it was the darkest evening of the year. I was reading it was like 10:30 or something. I was like, I just got to finish, and I couldn't do it. And I fell asleep, and I was like, fine, I'm going to bed. Went to bed, started having nightmares, woke up at like 3 a.m, just couldn't go back to sleep, came downstairs and finished the book.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that doesn't happen to me.
Yeah.
I don't. Cool.
All right. Well, thank you, both of you.
You are welcome.
All right. So anybody listening, let me know if you've read this book, you know, if you haven't done, then let me know if this becomes your first Dean Kuntz, if you haven't read any of his, and if you have any other favorites. All right, anyway, bye everybody. Cool.
Okay, bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.